Shema Yisrael.
And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Command the children of Israel that they bring unto thee pure oil olive, beaten for the light, to cause the lamps to burn continually in the tabernacle of the congregation. And it shall be a statute forever in your generations.
The eternal light. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light. This public service program comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Our story today is based on the novel Hear Ye Sons by Irving Fineman and adapted for radio by Alan Lomax. Juano Hernandez is featured as the narrator.
Hear ye, sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father.
It is as if I have lived two lives. The second began 40 years ago when I came to America. And that life my children can understand. But my first life, my youth in the old country, is a lost world to my children, to Naomi and Janet and the others. When I try to tell them of this lost world of my youth, they shake their heads indulgently, as if I were recounting some dream I have had.
Father's telling one of his stories again.
But they're good stories, Naomi.
Nonsense, Janet. They're old-fashioned. They have nothing to do with us now. They're
vestiges of the past.
Yes, that's just what they are.
Father's not vestigial.
Obviously not. I am, after all, a fairly successful American lawyer.
Then why don't you leave that horrid old apartment on the river and your old Talmudist friends for a good neighborhood near us?
Because I like my old friends and their old-fashioned ways. I could no more give them up than I could my own youth.
I agree with you, Father.
Thank you, my dear.
And your stories, Father, they're wonderful. They really are. Grand material for a book. Father, you really ought to write them down. I mean, really.
For Naomi, I am an old fogey, and even Janet appreciates my story as if it were a mellow ruin of some rare old print. And that is as it should be. This first life of mine is a sort of museum piece. But perhaps if I set it down, my children may see its strange beauty and terror. For it was no dream, but a life that was lived. And so I say, as Moses once said to the children of Israel, Ask now of the days that are past, which were before thee, whether there hath been any such thing. The town where I was born in Russian Poland was a peaceful little country place. The natives of the district were simple, kindly peasants. On market days, they came to town to buy and sell. And afterwards, they sat in my father's store, stuffing their pipes with strong, acrid tobacco and puffing out clouds of smoke. And their talk was slow and concerned with the eternal things of the land.
Why is this so, Feodor? Calves are slaughtered constantly and colts are never killed.
Well?
Well, why then are there more cows than horses?
A good question, my brother.
And there would ensue a few moments of thoughtful and smoky silence among the peasants. Then Feodor would shift his massive thighs and remove his pipe deliberately from his lips.
There are more colts than horses in our district, dear brother, because horses are more often stolen.
Ah, I see.
And the rascally czarist officials, in exchange for bribes, even help the thieves.
That is true, Fyodor. I recall such an incident myself.
Yes, these peasants of Russian Poland were simple, kindly folk. And we dwelt among them in peace and neighborliness. Like them, we suffered under the laws of the Tsar. Except, in our case, the laws were more ruthless. Like them, we interpreted many things that happened as signs and portents and miracles. Indeed, I myself was born, according to the account of my parents, with the might of the rabbi. My mother often told how she went one day to wise old Rabbi Hennick.
Peace be to you, Rabbi Hennick.
And to you, peace, daughter.
I come to you in great trouble, Rabbi.
Is it some frightened dream, daughter?
No.
Has your family broken the Sabbath law?
None of these things, Rabbi.
Speak, daughter, and ease your heart.
I want a son, Rabbi, a Kaddish. One to pray for me when I am gone. And two, I wish to please my husband. Four daughters I have borne him, and he says that he is content. But I know his heart, Rabbi, and in his heart he is not happy. A man must have a son. And in this I have failed my husband.
You are a good woman, Rebecca, and the Lord will help you. It is written that works of charity have more value than sacrifices. And it is said in the Talmud that the noblest of all charities is enabling the poor to earn a livelihood. Hence I tell you to gather together 52 rubles and distribute them among the poor. And perhaps God will help you, and you will have a son.
And my mother followed the instructions of Rabbi Hennick, distributed money to the needy, and collected blessings for her interest. God listened to those blessings of the poor, and, as my mother used to say, I was born in a fortunate hour. My father danced and shouted and spread a feast for his friends at a ceremony of the covenant of Abraham.
And his name will be called in Israel. And his name will be called in Israel. Well, Samuel, have you chosen a name for your son?
Rabbi?
A name for your son.
Why, name? Rabbi, may the Lord forgive me, but I've been so happy I've not thought of it. Rabbi, what shall I call my dear son?
Let him be given the name Rachel gave to her firstborn.
Yes, so it shall be. Drink, friends, drink in health. For this day I am blessed with a son in my house. And his name is called Joseph.
I remember a day, a bright and shining day, when I was 9. I had been given a new fringed undervest of silk with blue and white stripes. On my feet were new Russian boots with painted heels. And, delighting in the June sunshine, I strolled out of the Jewish quarter into the town park, strolled out under the trees. I hummed a song because of the joy I felt. I looked at the shade trees and at the fine ladies and the gentlemen, and my heart overflowed. And I hoped that some of these ladies and gentlemen would notice the fine squeak of my boots. Then...
Here! Stop, Joe! Stop! You pesky little Jew, don't you know you ain't allowed here?
No, sir.
This park is for Christians, not for such as you, do you hear?
Yes, sir.
And just to see you remember your place, we'll take you to see the magistrate.
No,
come
sir,
along,
policeman,
now.
Come along. Please don't put me in jail.
But the huge policeman had tight hold on my collar and dragged me off to the station. The news of my arrest traveled like a flash to the ghetto, and my father came running to plead for me before the magistrate.
What do you want, Jew?
My son, your lordship.
Your son? Don't talk nonsense, Jew. What do I have to do with your son? Come, come, make yourself clear.
The boy, Joseph, your lordship, he's my son.
This young rascal, this impudent, lawless brat, this young criminal...
He's only 9, Your Honor.
Well, not too young to learn that he's a Jew. Not too young to know his place. Stop sniveling. Stop it. I'll have no weeping and moaning in my court.
Hush, Joe, hush. Your Lordship, I have another errand here. My people have asked me to bring you a slight token of their esteem for your learning and your sense of justice. I pray that you do not hold this gift an impertinence on our part.
Why, no, not at all. Not at all. Most respectful. Most respectful indeed. Yes, and now for this brat of yours. He's broken the law. The Tsar's law, and he must be punished.
He's only a child, Your Lordship.
Well, then, a light sentence for your good manners, Jew. You may stay in jail in his place. One day and one night. And see to it that your brat learns that he's a Jew. Next case.
I had learned. The scene burned into my heart forever. The fat, mocking policeman, the filthy jail, and my father sitting quietly in the corner intoning the psalms. Yes, I had learned that in my sleepy country town, snowbound in the winter and mudbound in the summer, there was a wall beyond which I could not go. And what was there then for a young Jew, my children have asked me? Well, there was the cheder.
Ma pach, ma pach, pashto,
pashto,
zakev,
zakev.
The cheder school, where good old Reb Sholem taught me from the time I was 5 until I was 13. And after the cheder, there was the Beis Hamidrash, where every day I lived elevated and apart in the world of subtle learning, that is the Torah. The years slipped by almost unnoticed, and by the time I was 18, I was, in truth, more away from this world than in it. Then one day, as I stood dreaming at the window, I saw a girl walking in the sunshine.
How beautiful are her feet and sandals.
And as I spoke these words, I blushed to the roots of my hair and turned to find the eye of my father on me.
And Abiah said of the evil one, scholars, he tempts more than anyone else. No, no, Joseph, do not look so ashamed. For it is also written at 18 to the nuptial canopy. And to be unmarried is to live without joy, without blessing, without kindness, without religion, without peace. Yes, Joseph, it's time I arranged a match for you.
From that time on, I lived in a world that was strange to me. I scarcely ate. I walked as if afloat. The little puffs of dust raised by my feet were supporting clouds. And one day, I came home to find a stranger talking with my father in the parlor. I greeted him as calmly as I could.
Peace be to you.
And to you, peace. A fine-looking son you have, Samuel.
He is a good boy.
My son, I've heard that you are a very studious young man. Let me hear something of your learning so that I may know if you are worthy to be the bridegroom of my roof.
I felt like a schoolboy on exhibition, but not wishing to disappoint my parents who were looking at me with pride, I launched at once into a discussion of the Talmud and answered many difficult questions. I displayed the wealth of my studies, and when I was finished, my prospective father-in-law turned to my father, beaming with delight.
Samuel, I thought the bridegroom's price you set for your son was too high, but on the contrary, I would pay 10 times as much to have such a son-in-law in my house.
Thank you, Arioway.
No, no, let me rather thank you, Samuel. And now, let's not put off the wedding forever. If you agree, I say 6 weeks from now.
A And so it was agreed. And Arya Weiss returned to Mishenets to arrange the wedding. That night, I went out of the house to walk by myself and collect my whirling thoughts. I passed the daughters of Aaron the baker. They were thick-bodied, red-faced, and their voices were like the voices of crows. I shuddered as I hurried past them, and the dreams I had had of a gentle princess turned into a nightmare. In vain, I tried to convince myself that personal beauty was not important in man or woman, but it was no good. I could not bear the thought of a homely bride, and although I spoke to no one of this, I was still plunged in gloomy thoughts when, 6 weeks later, we set out for Mishenets and the wedding. And so we came to Mishenets and the house of my father-in-law. The room was warm and crowded. The wedding guests were dancing, and I was almost suffocated in my anxiety actually to see my bride-to-be.
Come, make way for the bridegroom. Let him see his bride. Let him see his little beauty.
And the crowd of maidens drew aside, and I trembled as I looked up. Then I saw Ruth for the first time, a slender figure, white throat rising above a chain of gold, round, soft chin, delicate lips, wide-open dark eyes, set in a pale oval face. And in that instant, I saw a flicker over her gentle face, a look of dread relieved, a look that was a reflection of the feeling that was in my own heart. At that moment, I was certain that God was good.
She is a sweet girl, my son, as tender as she is beautiful.
A rose of Sharon, my boy, and now to be yours.
But there is a question you must answer. Shall the bride's hair be cut short in the fashion of the old ways, or be left uncut?
My voice trembled, but I summoned all my dignity and said,
"It is not proper to do anything to disturb the joy of the bride. Let it go on till after the wedding."
Ruth looked at me gratefully. Then I placed the silken veil over her head and was led out of the house into the street where the guests were gathering.
Your right foot first, Joseph.
Yes, my son, so that the home will be fortunate.
Play, play, musicians. Play your liveliest tune.
The way was across the market square, where the file of black-coated men and the procession of gaily dressed women converged on a canopy set up before the synagogue. All raised their candles high in the air as the rabbi, his face radiant under the pointed skullcap, began his sermon.
"This, my children, is the most momentous hour of your lives. You are about to make a covenant of partnership with the Almighty."
I glanced at Ruth
and
beside
you must know
me,
that all your
mysterious
life
and beautiful,
all your being
under the folds of her veil. And my heart quickened at the thought of how she had looked into my eyes.
Remember that you are going to be the collaborators in the endless story of creation that began in Genesis. So God will sustain you with all that is good. Amen.
And as the musicians played a plaintive march, Ruth was guided so that she moved slowly about me under the canopy. Seven times she circled around me so that I felt wound in the white web of her mysterious presence until she and I became part of the endless turnings of the universe. At length she stood again at my right hand and I slipped a ring on her finger.
"Repeat after me, my son. Hareat.
Hareat.
Mekudeshesli.
Mekudeshesli.
Betabasu.
Betabasu.
Kedas.
Kedas.
Moshe v'Yisroel.
Moshe v'Yisroel."
Two goblets of wine were handed to the rabbi, and he began the chant of the seven blessings.
Baruch ato Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam Borei peri hagafen.
Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who created all manner of joy and gladness, the joys of triumph and peace, the rejoicing of love, the delight of the bridegroom and the bride, of the dance and song, of brotherhood and friendship.
In the moonlight, the musicians leading the way, Ruth and I walked back across the square to her father's house. The whole town was dancing and singing around us. Indeed, it seemed to me everything was dancing. The air, the candles, the very stars. And we went in to supper and afterwards danced until morning came. One evening at sundown, when we'd been married about 2 weeks, Ruth came into the room where I was reading.
Husband.
It was the first time Ruth had ever called me husband. The letters on the page swam before my eyes.
Husband.
I stared harder at my book and pretended not to notice her, although indeed I had heard her first footstep on the stair below. I had heard the light rustle of her dress as she entered the door.
Joseph, my husband.
Ruth laid her hand on mine, and my heart sounded like thunder in my ears.
Joseph, aren't you weary of your book?
Yes, very weary.
When you didn't answer, I thought...
You were wrong. I only wanted to hear you call me husband again.
I knew that.
How?
Because I know you so well, my husband. We're not strangers anymore. We're like old, old friends. But, oh, Joseph, I was so frightened of you before I saw you.
Why?
Because I thought you might be...
Horrible?
Yes. How did you know, Joseph?
Because I was afraid, too. Afraid you wouldn't be pretty. And now it seems to me I've known you all my life.
I know. I can't remember when I first saw you, Joseph. And now it seems... Don't laugh at me. It seems just as if we'd been born together.
And indeed, it was so. For were we not born together into manhood and womanhood? We who had been just simple children before our marriage. And thinking what a miracle had befallen us, I kissed Ruth, led her downstairs, and went to the synagogue for evening prayers. Half the heavens were steeped in the blue portent of a clear and starry night. But in the west, the sunset sky was aflame with the joyousness of my spirit.
Eishes ha'il mimitza, eishes ha'il mimitza, verachok mipninim mikro.
And this is the way my life began, in a land that is so far away that it is like another world to my American children. Another world or a dream. And yet, it was no dream, but a life that was lived. Hear ye, sons, and ask now of the days that are past, which were before thee, whether there hath been any such thing.
The dramatic portion of our Eternal Light program today was based on the novel Hear Ye Sons by Irving Feynman, author of Dr. Adams, Jacob, and other novels. And now we take pleasure in presenting U.S. Army Chaplain Isidore Signer of Chanute Field, who will talk from Chicago.
This dramatization pictures the customs and practices current in Jewish life only a generation or so ago. They in turn reflect the lofty conceptions which Israel evolved of the relationship of man and woman to each other and of both to God and to the community of which they are a part. The ideas concerned with love, marriage, and the family provided the Jew with pivotal values, enabling him to keep his balance when buffeted by the winds of cruel chance and mishap. In a day when marriage vows are apt to be lightly taken and just as lightly kept, it is well to think of marriage as neither conquest nor even partnership, but as collaboration with God. That moment, which is at the same time the culmination of courtship and the beginning of family life, is kiddushin, meaning not marriage, but sanctification, as if to say that the Jewish home should be not even castle, but shrine. Kiddushin implies that the holiness of the relationship depends not upon any formula uttered under the canopy, but on the frame of mind with which the man and woman enter the married state. In the Hebrew, ishon, woman, is synonymous with bais, the home. To be sure, their husband and wife, entities engaged in a romantic and often great enterprise, but as parents they represent the repositories of the traditions of the race. Hence, their offspring are not only bonim children, but bonim builders as well. Love, says Maimonides, is the motive which gives all human action its true ethical value. But love by itself is not firm enough to form the foundation of life, whether in individuals who must strive for self-fulfillment or in society which cannot afford to tolerate wrongdoing. In all human relationships, love must be governed by disciplines. Otherwise, love may fail. Love succeeds and fulfills itself when in marriage, the disciplines of human relationships are practiced in the building of the home and the rearing of children. It wasn't merely a naive conceit that prompted our forefathers to view marriages as made in heaven when they said that 40 days before the formation of a child, a heavenly voice announces, "This person is to marry so-and-so's daughter." They believed that as children of God, we are to exercise order and planning in our relationships and to be held together by something more coercive than voluntary affection. Surely that is why they taught that when a man and woman merit it by their actions and behavior, the divine presence dwells in their midst. For marriage is neither conquest nor partnership, but in that union God occupies first place. He's the third party in the relationship whose prime purpose is to make for the continuation and preservation of the race. Men and women are collaborators with him in the work of creation. Could any loftier conception of love, marriage, and the family ever be evolved by the human mind?
Thank you, Chaplain Signer. Next week, The Eternal Light presents the concluding portion of our adaptation of Irving Feynman's novel, Hear Ye Sons. Music for today's program was composed by Morris Momorsky and conducted by Milton Catons. Cantor Robert H. Siegel of the Beacon Street Temple, Brookline, Massachusetts, was the soloist. Juano Hernandez was featured as the narrator. The entire production was under the direction of Frank Papp. This program is a public service of the National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations and is presented under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This is the National Broadcasting Company.